Welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine for this Thursday, August 12th. Thanks for tuning us in tonight. We will be rebroadcasting a show that originally aired on September 15, 2011. Our guest was David Linden, professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University. He talked about the pleasure centers of the brain and his book from 2011 called The Compass of Pleasure. So, enjoy this blast from the past. From sex to drugs to greasy hamburgers, this is the Perpetual Notion Machine for Thursday, September 15th, 2011. I'm your host, Dennis Schaefer. Tonight, hear in detail about why you seek the pleasures in life that you do with an interview with researcher and author David Linden. Dr. David Linden is a professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University, where he researches memory in the brain at the cellular level and is a popularizer of brain science. His first book, The Accidental Mind, How Brain Evolution Has Given Us Love, Memory, Dreams, and God, explains how the human brain evolved to its current powerful yet inefficient state. Dr. Linden has more to say about this in the upcoming interview. Dr. Linden's latest book, The Compass of Pleasure, explains how we feel pleasure in the brain, whether it is a hamburger, sex, alcohol, exercise, learning, or gambling. The brain is stimulated by these chemicals or activities in very similar ways, activating parts of the brain, such as the medial forebrain bundle, the ventral tegmental area, striatum, hippocampus, nucleus accumbens, and the amygdala. Studies on these areas have helped us understand why we do what we do and how we can help those of us who do them too much. For example, our view of drug addiction has advanced our understanding on how to treat individuals. They are now not viewed as people who should know better or have bad morals, but as people predisposed to this condition who need legitimate help. Brain research also suggests a variety of ways to give addiction sufferers this help. More recently, research of other addictions, such as those to sex and food, show that they have similar and sometimes more complex mechanisms in the brain. Such findings can help us advance how we medically and socially treat these addictions. With that, we will now broadcast for you an interview between PNM reporter Mark Formanek and Dr. Linden.
When I was looking into the brain, I heard people talk about how the brain is maybe the most complicated object in the universe, and even though that's, you know, makes the brain, that's sort of putting the brain on a pedestal, but like your first book, The Accidental Mind, comes from the premise that the brain might be complex, but it's really a cobbled, I think you recorded saying it was a cobbled together mess. Could you explain that statement a bit? It might lay some foundation for what we'd be discussing in this interview.
Well, certainly. So it's very impressive what the brain can do. I mean, we've got this 2.5 pounds of tissue, and it is the substrate for our mental life, and that is indeed amazing and wonderful. However, it doesn't follow from that it is particularly well engineered. And the brain, like all things in biology, developed through evolution. And Francois Jacob, the famous molecular biologist, famously said, evolution is a tinkerer, not an engineer. And so if you look at the brain, either in terms of its structure, or in terms of its electrical function, or in terms of its genetics, what you find is that it really is a cobbled together mess, that it was never designed all at once by a genius inventor on a blank sheet of paper. It was gradually accreted through millions of years of evolutionary history, providing ad hoc solutions to the problem at hand at any given moment. It's sort of like this. Imagine if someone said to you, all right, your job is to build the latest, greatest Formula One race car. And you say, oh, that sounds really fun, really creative. Yeah, I could really have some new ideas for that. And then you sign the contract. And after they sign the contract, they say, well, actually, there's a hitch we didn't tell you about. We're going to give you a Model T Ford, and the way you build your Formula One race car is by adding things to it and not taking anything away. And that's more or less how the evolution of the brain has proceeded. It is grossly agglomerative and inefficient. And to me, what's interesting about that is not just the point that it's inefficient, but that the particular inefficiencies and compromises that have come out of brain design are absolutely central to our humanity. They have given rise to things like love, like our human monogamous mating system, which is highly unusual in the mammalian world.
And in what ways is it unusual?
Well, if you look across mammalian species, 90% of them do not form lasting pair bonds. They, in most cases, the male wanders off, doesn't recognize his offspring, doesn't form a lasting pair bond. And in most species, highly promiscuous sex is within, you know, on the same day is very common. That's the natural order of things. You only have situations like those famous penguins in Antarctica and humans in cases where having paternal involvement in child rearing is something that confers a strong evolutionary advantage. And in the case of humans, the reason it does comes from the fact that human children have by far the longest childhood of any animal. And the reason they do that has to do with the very slow maturation of their brains.
Okay. And also, when you're talking about the, you know, how evolution kind of comes together in a way of saying you have to make a race car, but you can only add to it and not so much subtract from it. When you think, I'm just thinking about how when people think about evolution, they always think it's kind of like an upward, like you're always evolving to something better, but that's not necessarily the case. It's random selection, random changes that sometimes they work at the time, but they don't necessarily work overall. You know, and maybe we have things like appendix or whatever that may have functioned at one point, but we still have it, and it's really not working that well now.
Well, right. I mean, there's a tendency to kind of make just so stories about evolution, and there's a tendency to get all rapturous, you know, to say, oh, look at the design of the shark. Isn't the shark so optimal for swimming? Isn't evolution wonderful? Isn't everything wonderful? And you're left with the notion that evolution always yields the optimal solution to any given problem. And that's wrong in two different ways. First of all, evolution only you know, all that evolution does is act on you know, what's the environment and what's reproductive success, and anything else doesn't matter. So the just good enough solution is just as effective as the elegant solution. Likewise, evolution only cares about you getting your genes into the next generation. Evolution doesn't care whether you have a fulfilled later life stage, for example, right? It's absolutely immaterial. The other thing, and this is particularly relevant for human evolution, is that evolution is an extraordinarily slow process, and human technologies and cultures can change very, very quickly. So what can happen is you have situations where things that may have served us very well 100 generations or 500 generations ago aren't serving us very well anymore. And one example that comes up has to do with our inborn human proclivity to like sweet things and fatty things to eat, right? And so if you're in a hunter-gatherer society where you are often at risk of starvation, it's very advantageous to anytime you encounter a calorically dense sweet or fatty food to snarf it all down. And that's a good thing to do because you can pile on some fat, and the next time the next famine comes, maybe you'll survive it with your fat stores. But of course, if you live in North America and you're fortunate enough not to be desperately poor and you have access to unlimited calories, like most of us do in North America, then those human predilections for diet don't serve us very well at all. And in that case, what evolution has built lags the present situation.
Oh, yeah, and you brought up things, you know, like seeking out sweet and fatty foods, and even what you're talking about with love. I think we all experience, or we all know that there's a lot of, you know, we're driven by, you know, the pleasure of eating those types of foods, or the pleasure of love. And that's the whole focus of your book, The Compass of Pleasure. And so I wanted to get into kind of how the brain perceives or, is pleasured, I guess, in a sense. But you mentioned in the book that what we think is the driving force of pleasure wasn't really a sound theory back maybe like 50, 60 years ago, where there was this drive reduction hypothesis. We thought that scientists thought that the brain was kind of driven by rather, you know, a lack of pain rather than the fulfillment of pleasure.
Right. So in the earliest part of the 20th century, there was much more, particularly with the outgrowth of behaviorism, B.F. Skinner and a number of other people, the dominant way of thinking about animal behavior had to do with avoiding aversive, painful, unpleasant stimuli. And a lot of this came from animal training. And it really wasn't until the 1950s, when Olds and Milner found a place in the brain that when they passed a weak electrical current would cause animals to be rewarded, to feel pleasure, that the focus on the pleasure circuit in the brain and its importance for behavior really started to take off.
But it seems like just being a human, you experience a lot of pleasure and you feel like you want to do that more, whatever it is, eat this thing more, or play this game more, or talk to this person more. Why was that kind of overlooked before Olds and Milner found those places in the brain?
Well, that's a good question, and quite honestly, someone who has a better grasp of the history of psychology and biological psychology would give a better answer than I can. I don't really know that history very well. What I can tell you, what we know now, is, you know, you might ask, well, why even have a pleasure center in our brain? And we now know. I mean, the central point of my book, The Compass of Pleasure, is that there is this medial forebrain pleasure circuit. It's evolutionarily ancient. We share it with animals like lizards, and even critters without a proper brain have a rudimentary version of it. Even earthworms have a rudimentary version of it. And this is an area that involves a brain region called the ventral tegmental area and a neurotransmitter called dopamine and an area called the nucleus accumbens and a number of other regions that are connected with these. And when you have activity in these areas that causes release of dopamine, you feel pleasure. And so if we were to have you in a brain scanner and you're hungry and you're eating a delicious food that you like, that would light up. If you're having an orgasm in the brain scanner, it would light up. If you're drinking water when you're thirsty would light up. And so this sort of points out the real evolutionary reason to have that, and that is you want eating food and drinking water and having sex to be pleasurable, because then those promote behaviors that cause you to survive and have offspring and get your genes into the next generation.
Quick question. Are these centers, if you're eating, drinking, or having sex, are they similar areas in the brain, or are they the same areas in the brain?
Well, so there's kind of a final common pathway for pleasure that involves these dopaminergic fibers from the ventral tegmental area and a number of different places where they project. So it's not precisely the same. But the pleasure, there's a final common pathway for pleasure, and so they will all overlap significantly. Now, obviously you know from your own experience that having an orgasm and eating pastrami sandwich or whatever it is that you happen to find particularly delicious don't feel the same. And so they're not going to have the same patterns of brain activation. I think what we should realize is that activation of this pleasure circuit shows us what is necessary to feel pleasure, but it doesn't show us what is sufficient. In other words, most of the pleasures that we have in our life are behaviorally complicated, and they're endowed with wonderful human richness by all the sensory experiences and memories and associations and emotions that are entangled with them. So that makes, you know, having an orgasm be, you know, from sexual contact be a much richer experience than if we just stuck an electrode in your pleasure center and activated it artificially.
Yeah, there were a lot of experiments that would do that with animals and some with humans, actually, which I think you went in your book that, or wrote in your book that maybe that wasn't as ethical, but we learned a lot that you could stimulate those parts of the brain and people basically kind of get addicted to that. So
Well, right. So it's been done, was originally done with rats, and with the rats it was rather dramatic. So, you know, if you have an animal that has an electrode in its medial forebrain pleasure circuit, then you give it a little lever it can press with its paw to stimulate that region, well, that rat will just basically whack on the lever all day and all night. It will ignore food and water and sex and its offspring and just self-stimulate the pleasure center to the exclusion of all else. I mean, not that different from end-stage, say, cocaine or amphetamine or heroin addiction in humans. And there have been a few cases in humans, some cases where they particularly tried to target the pleasure center, and there were notions that this could be used to relieve depression. It was also used in one famous unethical case to try to change the sexual orientation of a gay man and make him straight by showing him hetero porn while he was stimulating his pleasure center. That didn't really work out very well, and was, you know, just I can't imagine that would be allowed in the present day.
Yeah,
the 1960s.
Yeah.
Not, at least not in the U.S.
Yeah.
But you never know. It points out the need for very, very clear oversight for these kinds of experiments, both in humans and in animals. The interesting thing is that, so we've got this ancient pleasure center for eating and drinking and having sex, but of course, clever us, we've figured out how to activate it artificially. And that's usually not with an electrode. Usually it's with something we've extracted from a plant, like nicotine or heroin or cocaine. And so, or alcohol. So all of these things all activate the medial forebrain pleasure circuit, and they are all potential substrates for addiction. So if you look at psychoactive drugs, not all psychoactive drugs activate the pleasure circuit. So, for example, the hallucinogens, LSD and mescaline do not. SSRI antidepressants do not. Certain tranquilizers do not. And the ones that don't are not drugs that carry a risk for addiction. And the drugs that do carry a risk for addiction all, either directly, like amphetamine and cocaine, or indirectly, like cannabis or alcohol or nicotine or heroin, all ultimately potentiate dopamine signaling within the pleasure circuit of the brain.
And that's not the whole story of addiction, right? There's actual changes. I mean, that when you use a drug, it's potentiating glutamate, and so that you're feeling more pleasurable. It's stimulating that pleasure circuit in the brain, but then there's actual long-term changes in the brain that facilitate the addiction. Is that right?
Well, right. That's absolutely true. So I think it's worthwhile to talk about two things. First of all, what determines the propensity for addiction? And then second of all, the question you bring up is that, you know, as you routinely use one of these substances, what are the changes that happen within your pleasure circuit? And so really the first question, we know from studying families that about 40% of the propensity for addiction can be accounted for by hereditary factors. Now, there's not a single addiction gene, and actually there are probably many genes that contribute to this, and we don't know all of them, but some of them, not surprisingly, affect dopamine signaling within the pleasure circuit. And the way they do that is a bit counterintuitive. We might imagine that, well, if you have a genetic predisposition for addiction, it's because you feel extra pleasure from whatever it is that you're indulging, and then that motivates you to overdo it and be an addict. But it actually turns out to be just the opposite. So if you carry gene variants that damp down the dopamine functioning in your pleasure circuit, then you will try to seek that same set point of pleasure that others, so-called normals, can get with more moderate consumption. So I might go into the bar and have two whiskeys and feel good and laugh with my friends and go home, and someone else, to get the same pleasure buzz, might have to have eight whiskeys and become totally intoxicated, right? Because their dopamine signaling was reduced in order to feel to get as much dopamine release as I got, they had to overdo it.
Oh,
so that
I see.
Accounts for about 40% of the predisposition.
Mm-hmm.
The remainder has to do with life experience, and stress has a very, very big contribution.
Mm-hmm.
And we think about stress as being, you know, this kind of, now we're in the realm of psychology, we're away from biology, and that's really not true. So, you know, if you're sacked from your job, or you have an argument with your sweetheart, or if you're fighting off a viral infection, all of those things cause your adrenal glands that sit on top of your kidneys to secrete stress hormones. And those stress hormones pass into your brain, and they bind receptors on neurons in the pleasure circuit, and they set in motion a series of biochemical and electrical changes that make you crave. And as you pointed out, there are changes that happen as addiction progresses. So, for example, if we were to take autobiographies of a sex addict and a gambling addict and a heroin addict and lay them out in front of us, and then we paid someone to take out all the words that made specific reference to sex or gambling or heroin, what we'd see would be three versions of the same story arc in front of us, and it would go like this. Well, I did this thing and it felt good, so I did it more and it felt good and that was great. But then I noticed that as time went on, I needed to do it more and more often and more intensively in order to get the same pleasure. And then as time went on more, I found that actually all my liking was converted to wanting. All my pleasure was converted to craving. And in the end, I needed to have sex compulsively or take heroin or gamble, not because it made me feel good, but just to avoid feeling bad, just to be able to fall asleep at night and get up in the morning and not have a panic attack and face the day at all. And So as you correctly mentioned earlier, this progression from liking to wanting, this trajectory of addiction, is accompanied by a series of changes in the strength of synaptic connections within the pleasure circuit, with the biochemical and electrical function of those neurons, and even at the anatomical level, with the very fine structure of the information receiving end of these neurons called dendrites, which have little nubbins called dendritic spines. And those dendritic spines seem to bloom at very high density as addiction progresses.
Yeah, that's the part that seems, I mean, this all seems very scary in a sense. Especially, well, with the last part where your looks like your neurons, your brain is changing structure.
Addiction rewires your brain. There is no question about that. And here's what's worse, right? So, let's say you're a cocaine addict and you get clean, and you're clean for 2 years. Well, probably, I mean, from what we infer from the animal data, when we can really go into the brain and look at it carefully, whereas with humans we're sort of limited to things like brain scanners that don't give a very detailed view. But if we can extrapolate from what we can see in a rat, it really looks like your brain has changed for a very, very, very long time. Even after 2 years of living clean, your brain's pleasure circuit doesn't look like someone who never got addicted and got clean. It's altered on a very long-term basis. And that alteration can make you have continued cravings. That alteration can make it harder for you to take pleasure from other things than cocaine. And that alteration makes it so that you're sensitized. So if you have a slip and you are at a party and you take a toot of that cocaine, you're actually going to get more pleasure than someone who is taking that toot for the very first time.
Yeah. And you even mentioned in your book a quote from Jeff Tweedy from the band Wilco about he was addicted to a variety of drugs through his life, but now he's come, you know, he's been clean, I don't know for how long, but now he seems to be addicted to running. So he needs to be addicted. His brain is set up to be addicted to something. Is that kind of what that?
Well, you know, right. That's what Tweedy said. And, you know, I mean, obviously being addicted to running is a whole lot better than being addicted to alcohol or pills or
exactly.
You know, whatever it is that, mm-hmm. that he was indulging in the bad days. But, you know, I think what he points out shows very well. A lot of times, if you are going to successfully stay clean, then really what you got to do is sort of substitute some other pleasure. And, you know, there are some of those that you know, you can do a whole lot of. You can do a whole lot of exercise. You can have a whole lot of sex, assuming you're doing it ethically and not, you know, using people in the process. And these are perfectly good things to substitute for your pills or alcohol or heroin or whatever.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for having this discussion with me and talking about the brain in general.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
You have just listened to an old PNM show from September 15, 2011. Our guest was Dr. David Linden. The producer and interviewer of this show was Mark Formanek, and the engineer was Ken Rainier. Perpetual Notion Machine's next show is next week.